If somebody turned the water off, would you push the panic button? Are you sure? Well, now, I'm not just talking about the fact that the water may be turned off in your own home. I'm talking about the fact that you belong to a community of possibly 2 million people, and you're out in the middle of a desert, and then somebody turned the water off. Now what? There's an interesting question in regard to the Israelites. If I were to ask you, where did they get their food, what would you say? Where did the Israelites get their food? Yeah. In what form?
Manna.
In manna, that's correct. God had a daily food drop there, and the manna came, except for Sabbath morning, there wasn't any, but the rest of the time they went out and got food. Where'd the water come from? Now remember, they moved many places around through the desert for 40 long years. Where did the water come from?
From God.
Well, sure, but then it has to get down here somewhere. It comes from God, but where? In what form? From Horeb? You remember that's where they first got it. It came out of the rock. What was the rock? What did the rock signify? Jesus Christ. So they had these streams, this life-giving stream flowing from the rock, which was symbolic of the life-giving salvation which comes from Jesus Christ. This was a constant lesson. But the water did not continue to flow from Horeb. Here it is. The water did not, however, continue to flow from Horeb. Wherever in their journeyings they wanted water, there from the clefts of the rock, it gushed out beside their encampment. You'll find that in Patriarchs and Prophets, page 411. Here they had, always beside their camp, this crystal clear flowing stream, which was a constant reminder of these life-giving streams flowing from Jesus. Psalms 105, verse 41. He opened the rock, and waters gushed out. They ran in the dry places like a river. But what happened this day? Let's go back and take a look at it. Suppose we were there. Here was an Israelite mother who wanted to get an early start on the day. She put a great earthen jug on her shoulder, and she went down to the river. She'd been going there ever since she was a little girl. And to her horror, there was nothing but sand. The river was gone. It was there yesterday, it was there last night, but now it was gone. I can see her standing there. Suddenly her nerveless fingers allow the jug to fall from her shoulders. It breaks into 1,000 pieces, and she turns and runs back to camp screaming, "Somebody turned the water off." And before long, the cry was over the total camp. Hundreds of thousands of people all crying at the same time, "Somebody turned the water off." There was real bedlam. Here they were on the borders of Edom, just a very few days from going into the promised land. They could see the hills of Palestine in the distance on the other side of the Jordan. God had it in his mind that he would impress the king of Edom to allow them to use his superhighway and they could buy food and water. And when the water was turned off, immediately they should have thought, "God turned the water off. He's always turned it on. He turned it off. We won't need it anymore." But what did they do? Oh, they murmured and complained. And this was the cause of Moses disobeying God's command to speak to a rock. And he struck it. Not once, but twice. And forfeited the one thing he wanted to do more than anything else in the world, and that was to take and lead the children of Israel, God's people, into the promised land. He wanted this so bad that he begged God, and finally God had to say to him, "Look, we won't speak any more of this matter." Blinded by unbelief. You see, God wanted to test these people. They were just children when their parents refused to go into Canaan back in the time of the spies. Now they were the adults. Their parents had all died in the desert. He wanted to see, would these people trust him? Had they learned to trust him after having water and food for 40 years? Their clothes didn't get old, their shoes never wore out. But no, they hadn't learned that lesson at all. They simply wished they'd died with their parents out in the wilderness. And because of this, God could not work in their behalf. And so the king of Edom said, no way, you're not going to use my highway. And they had to detour way around in the sand. Isn't it amazing? The results of unbelief. But hasn't this been the nemesis of the world ever since time began? Adam didn't believe that he would really die if he ate the fruit of the forbidden tree. The antediluvians didn't really believe there was going to be a flood. Noah and his descendants didn't really believe there wasn't going to be another one, and so they built the Tower of Babel. Abraham didn't really believe he was going to have a son when he was 100 years of age, says he fell on his face and laughed. And we see the results of Abraham's do-it-yourself plan today. Always, God has had a problem with people not believing, not simply taking him at his word, believing his promises. And isn't it strange when he has never failed? Not one of his promises has ever failed. Even when Jesus came, he ran into the same thing. He must have been very tired. He was teaching and healing constantly. And this particular weekend, he went home. Back to Nazareth. With relatives and friends, he could relax a little bit. My, what a stir this must have caused in Nazareth. Here was a local boy who had made good. And the news of what he was doing must have kept filtering back into town. I'm sure that the changing of the water into wine came back very rapidly, because it's just up over the hill and down the other side is where Cana. That's where the marriage feast was. It didn't take anybody very long to get from there back to Nazareth to tell, do you hear what the carpenter did? Turned water into wine. And now there had been people healed and sick people all over everywhere. Could face a whole new life. My, the crowds that must have followed him as he came into Nazareth this weekend. Old friends, as he greeted them, and they greeted him. On Sabbath, as his custom was, he went to the synagogue. The leader of the synagogue stood up and called for the book of Isaiah and read about the coming of the Messiah. And after he read about it, he exhorted the people that they would pray for the coming of the Messiah. Isn't this ironic? Here he was sitting right there. Then, because it was a custom, he asked this young teacher, this young rabbi, to say a few words. And Jesus took the book of Isaiah and read about himself. He read exactly what he'd do, what he would be doing when he came, the Messiah. Now, they should have recognized that what they heard and what he was reading were identical. They should have put the two together and said, hey, this must be the Messiah. But no, they didn't. They sat there completely thrilled with his manner and his beautiful speech. Everything was just fine. They sat there until he said, this day these words are fulfilled in your ears. And the shock was sudden and violent. But don't look down your noses at those poor Hebrews. How would you have reacted? You're sitting in church. Here is a visitor who stands up and suddenly announces that he is the Messiah. Only you knew him as a carpenter. He fixed your back porch. He put an addition on for you. How would you have reacted? Like they did? He said, who, you? The Messiah? Oh, come on. We know your brothers. We know your mother. We remember you when you were a little tiny kid bringing water up from the spring down to the bottom of the hill to your mother's house. Oh, it says they were offended. And then this very sad verse in Matthew 13, verse 58. And he did not there many wonderful works because of what? Their unbelief. That's right. There were whole towns, whole cities when Jesus passed through. The doctors went on a vacation. They closed the clinic. Everyone was well. Wasn't a sick person in town. Imagine but he couldn't do it in his own hometown of Nazareth because of their unbelief. I did find out that he healed a few people, but he must have done it on the way in. He certainly didn't do it on the way out. He was going out too fast because they were going to throw him off the cliff. Can we believe God? I was in an eastern city one time. We had a visitation program in this particular church, and the men of the church had gathered at a little school where I was explaining the procedures. And at the close of the meeting, and the men were making their exits, a man came up to me and said, "I know I should help out because I am the head deacon, but I have a peculiar situation. I'm sure you'll understand. I just won't be able to work the next 3 nights." And then he proceeded to tell me that he had gone to work for an insurance company about a month prior to this from New York. And at this particular moment, they had sent a man from New York down there just to train him. The man was staying there in the local motel, and they were working at night because that's when the husbands are home. So he said, "This fellow will only be here a certain length of time, and you can understand that I won't be able to do it." My first reaction was this, that, "Well, there's no problem. I'll take your place, or we can manage, or whatever." Only the Lord could have asked me to, or impressed me to say what I did. I said, "I wonder what you had done if you'd have been an Israelite." And he said, "What do you mean?" So at the blackboard, I drew a rough sketch of Palestine. The Mediterranean Sea, the Sea of Galilee, and the Red Sea with the Jordan River running down. And I explained to him that when the Israelites came into the Promised Land, God did not clear out all the heathen. There was a pocket of Jebusites right there at the site of Jerusalem, clear to the time of David. There were Philistines near the coast. There were Edomites down below. And then came Moabites, and then Amorites, and there were a few other ites here and there and yonder. There were still quite a few heathen people. And God did not clear them out for two specific reasons which he gives. Number one, that the beast of the field would multiply against them, and there were lions and bears, you recall. Number two, that the fields would grow up to briars and thistles and thorns, and God wanted them to move in when everything was beautiful. He said that they would move into houses they didn't build, and towns they didn't build the walls. They would harvest fields that they didn't plant. That was God's plan. And so he said, "As you increase in size, then I will move these out." And God had one of the most effective armies I've ever heard of. Hornets. I learned about hornets when I was a small boy. I lived near a large river, and there was an old cottonwood down there. And hanging from one of the low boughs of this cottonwood was a great hornet's nest. And we small boys liked to take rocks and throw at the hornet's nest. Fortunately, we never got very close and we weren't very accurate, and the hornets simply ignored us. But as I grew older, and I suppose bolder, I was down there looking for a heifer that had run away one evening, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to hit the hornet's nest? So I got a rock. Now I could run faster. And I thought, I will run in real close so I can't possibly miss. And I ran fast, and the rock poised, and when I got in real close, I threw. And I didn't miss, and neither did they. And I have learned to respect hornets from that day to this. So that last year, when the hornets built a nest up in the eave of my house, my wife said, "Why don't you take the hornet's nest down?" "Oh," I said, "there's no problem. They won't hurt anybody." She said, "I don't like them around." "No," I said, "they won't bother you." She said, "This isn't like you. Why don't you just take it down?" I said, "Look, the hornets and we have an agreement. This fall, they'll go to California or Mexico or someplace, and when they're gone, I'll take their house down." And that's what happened. No, God was going to use the hornets simply to drive the heathen out. There'd been no problem. Now, here was the problem that I proposed to this man. You have a little 40-acre strip, which is your inheritance. It's right on the edge of Ammon. Now, 3 times every year, the Lord has directed that you and your sons must go to the tabernacle, later to the temple, for the feast. Your wife just had a baby a week ago. She can't go. Old grandma's there. She can't go. There's some small children there. They can't go. Now, would you follow God's plan and go, leaving your wife, your aged parents, your small children totally unprotected with some big muscular Ammonites on the other side of the fence? He said he didn't know. I said, I don't know either. But I told him, look, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. I was surprised when the next night he was working and the next and the next. I didn't ask him why he had changed his mind. I thought if he wanted to tell me, that would be all right. But it might be a sacred thing between him and God. And so the third night that we were waiting for some men, and another man did ask him, how come you were able to work? He said, well, the other evening I talked to the preacher and he asked me a question. And then he went to the blackboard and drew this map again and pointed out his little 40-acre strip on the edge of Ammon. And he said, would you go up to the tabernacle or to the temple for the feast and leave your wife unprotected? The fellow said, what did he say? And he said, or what did you say? He said, I said, I didn't know. What did he say? He said, he didn't know either. He said, when I went home, I drew it, this map on a piece of paper for my wife, and she asked the same questions. We didn't come to any decision. He said, the next morning after I rose, I said to my wife, what do you think? She said, I don't think you have any choice. And he said, I don't either. So he said, not knowing what would happen, I picked up the phone and called the man at his motel and told him that I had some work to do for the church for the next three evenings. I wouldn't be able to work. There was a pause, and finally he said, let's see, that's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And he said, yes. He said, well, that's great. He said, my sister had been wanting me to see her down on the East Shore for a long time. I'll go down and visit her. I'll see you Thursday. And then he added something else. In the daytime, I have been selling some insurance on my own. And in each day, I have sold more insurance than I ever sold in any previous week. What did happen? Did you ever stop to realize that the whole nation of Israel was totally unprotected? There wasn't a fighting man in the area with all of these heathen tribes all around them. They were all up there at the temple or tabernacle having choir practice, fellowship dinners, and all this thing. Have you ever wondered what happened? Here it is. How did God arrange it? Exodus, the 34th chapter, verses 23 and 24. Thrice in the year shall all your men children appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. For I will cast out the nations before thee and enlarge thy borders. Neither shall any man desire thy land when thou shalt go up to appear before the Lord thy God thrice in the year. And there it was. It was that simple. The Lord simply took the desire out of their hearts. In Christ's Object Lessons, page 301, God makes no requirement without making provision for its accomplishment. Did you get that? No requirement without making provision for its accomplishment. What is the trap which the devil has here? To block God's plans, the devil substitutes reason for faith. Reason said, yes, you have to stay home and take care of your family. Faith said, do it God's way. Is this a problem today, this problem of unbelief? I'm reading from Prophets and Kings, page 184, also from Testimonies to the Church, volume 2, page 196. The love of the world has a terrible hold upon the people whom the Lord has commanded to watch and pray always, lest coming suddenly he find them sleeping. They are becoming rich in worldly things, but not rich toward God. They do not believe in the shortness of time. They do not believe that the end of all things is at hand, that Christ is at the door. And if we want to realize how serious this really is, all we have to do is to read Revelation 21:8. There it lists all the terrible people that will be cast into the lake of fire as God cleanses this universe of sin. But heading that list are the fearful and the unbelieving. And there is a principle that goes like this. those who defer obedience till every shadow of uncertainty disappears and there remains no risk of failure or defeat will never obey at all. Why do men find it so hard to follow God's plans? First, because they do not know the principles involved in God's plans. I will list four. First, God knows exactly how the plan is supposed to be carried out. He doesn't give us a plan and say, well, if that doesn't work, we'll try something else or we'll make an adjustment. His plan is perfect from the beginning. Number two, he always has the person or people to carry out these plans. Number three, if skills are needed, he will provide the skills to carry out the plan. Number four, he always gives us the materials to carry out the plan before he gives us the plan. So this will be fastened in your memory. Think back to the time of Israel when he said, let them make a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. Did he know how the sanctuary was supposed to be built? In great detail. Moses not only saw a pattern of it, but he was given it detailed so he could write it down. The little minutest areas of the thing, even the dress of the priests who worked there. Did he have people to carry it out? Oh, definitely. Over a million of them. And a construction foreman's dream. They were all in unemployed. Only one big problem. They were all brickmakers. And God was going to make his tabernacle out of precious woods and stone, precious wood and precious stones, gold, silver, dyed skins, cleverly woven things. And all he had was brickmakers. Here came the skills. He called Aholiab and Bezalel and gave them these fantastic skills which they needed. And he gave skills to women who made the beautiful embroidery work. Did these skills suddenly die after the closing of the tabernacle? No, they didn't. These men passed these skills on to their descendants. And finally, when Solomon was ready to build his temple, he sent up to the king of Tyre who sent Huram. And Huram was a descendant of Aholiab through his mother. But Huram's father, evidently, or his mother, had gone up into this country. Their forebears had gone up into these heathen countries using their God-given skills where they could make more money than they could at home. And they were making things very offensive to God. It's interesting to note, if you read Prophets and Kings in this particular section, that God was displeased with Solomon for sending up and getting this man who was very selfish, that he would have raised up another man and given him the skills. And when Huram came down there, he infected the others with his selfishness, and they also demanded more money for their great skills. In came ease and luxury. And we are told to this may be traced one of the principal causes of the apostasy of Israel. What about the materials for the tabernacle? Well, the Israelites had 150 years of back wages coming. The Lord simply told them to borrow from the Egyptians, and the Egyptians were so sick of frogs and lice and flies, they gave them anything they wanted, and out they went. The record says they spoiled the Egyptians. Why? So they could put baubles in their ears and on their fingers? No. God knew that he was going to say, let them make a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, and he was simply providing the materials before. Even in the case of his own son, he followed the same plan. He had the plan of redemption from the foundation of the world. He sent his son down here. He had Joseph and Mary. Evidently, we didn't need the skill part right in this particular area, but they certainly needed some materials because Joseph and Mary were forced to flee into Egypt to escape Herod, who was going to kill all the children, and Joseph was a poor man. How did he get the money? What supported him during this stay in Egypt? Well, the wise men had come out of the east, you're right. How long before did the Lord direct the wise men by his stars so they arrived there with their gifts at the very time when Joseph needed it to carry the young Jesus down there? There must be a principle in our relationship to God's plans. And I think there is. We are limited to following directions. He is unlimited in producing the results. Did you get all of it? We are limited to following directions. He is unlimited in producing the results. I saw an elderly gentleman one time who had lost his employment. He wanted to talk to me, and so the pastor and I were visiting with him in his home. And he was calling attention to the fact that being old and losing his employment and not having any money stored up, and the fact that his wife had had a serious operation which had used up what little they had, that he was in a rather serious situation. And he said, "I'm really too old to find work." And I said, "Well, I wouldn't say that, because the Lord didn't put Moses to work until he was 80. I said, "The Lord expects all of us to work. And maybe you haven't been depending upon him. If you recognize that you're a steward, well, let's say, for instance, that you're working for me. Whose job is it to tell you what to do?" He said, "It would be yours." I said, "That's correct. I would say, do this, do that, work here, work there. What would be your position, your response?" And he said, or your responsibility. He said, "An honest day's labor." I said, "That's right. Now, if you recognize you're a steward of God, whose job is it to tell you what to do and where?" "Well," he said, "it would be God's." "That's right." I said, "That's correct. What you have to give is an honest day's labor. God might say, 'I want you to work over here. I want you to work there somewhere else.'" And he looked at me and said, "I believe that." The telephone rang out in another room. He went to answer the phone, and his wife kind of gave us a little briefing on their past problems, which led them up to this time now. And after a while, he came back into the room, and she had said as he was gone that he had been quite depressed after losing his job and not being able to find steady work. And she said, "When he said, 'I believe that,' the light came back in his eye." Well, I thought that was strange. So when he came back into the room, I looked to see the light in his eye, and I'm sure the pastor did. I didn't see anything unusual. He did have a rather puzzled look in his face. But it was something that his wife could see, that little spark that left when he became discouraged, I guess. So as I mentioned, he looked a little puzzled, and his wife said, "Who was it?" And he gave a man's name, and then he said to us, he lives just out of town, he's a rancher, and she said, "What did he want?" He said, "He just offered me a steady job." So we didn't kneel down and say, "Lord, here's your promise, please honor the promise." We knelt down and simply thanked God for answering. The minute the man said, "I believe that," God could work for him right there. When we devote ourselves to the affairs of the kingdom of God, he will mind our affairs. What a fantastic promise comes from the book Our High Calling, page 196. You want God for a manager? Then you take care of his affairs and he'll take yours. How about this one from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 243? "Let none waste time in deploring the scantiness of their visible resources. The outward appearances may be unpromising, but energy and trust in God will develop resources. Cause it a waste of time to worry about it, because if you're doing the Lord's work, he makes his own provision. When the Lord gives a work to be done, let not men stop to inquire into the reasonableness of the command or the probable results of their efforts to obey." That's from the same source, Prophets and Kings, page 243. Notice, "Let men not stop to inquire into the reasonableness of the command or the probable results of their efforts to obey. In the hands of the Lord, it will prove to be more than sufficient." I think one of the most beautiful promises is found in the book Ministry of Healing, page 481. "Our Heavenly Father has 1,000 ways to provide for us of which we know nothing. Those who accept the one principle of making the service of God supreme will find perplexities vanish and plain path before their feet." One day there was a man who came to a great physician And he said, I have taken my boy everywhere, but no one can heal him. Can you heal him? The great physician said, do you believe that I can? He said, you know, everything's possible to one who believes. Do you remember what the man said? Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.